Good morning. Hello, I'm Ken, live from the Talking Information Center. Today is Thursday, February the 12th, 2026. Happy birthday, Abraham Lincoln. I will be reading the February 13th edition of The Week magazine, and I will be beginning very first page with the editor's letter. President Trump's threat to seize control of elections. As explained in a further article called Controversy and His Ongoing Immigration Crackdown, grabbed the big headlines this week. But something else happened quietly. In the background, something that could pose an existential threat to human life. The new START, S-T-A-R-T, treaty, the last remaining pact limiting the number of nuclear warheads Russia and the U.S. can possess, was scheduled to take its final breath and expire on February 5th, with nobody even attempting to revive it. With no talks on for replacement in the works, the end of the New START means we have entered a renewed nuclear arms race. And the more weapons that exist, the greater the likelihood of an accidental launch or miscalculation or even a nuclear theft by terrorists. Ever since Nixon and Brezhnev signed the SALT I Treaty in 1972, we've had some kind of a pact in place or talks going on with the Soviets or Russians to rein in our respective nuclear arsenals. The most recent deal capped deployed strategic warheads at 1,550 each, more than enough to obliterate the enemy and much of the rest of the world to boot. Vladimir Putin has amusingly suggested that both sides volunteer to abide by that limit on the honor system, while President Trump is holding out for a treaty that would also rope in China and its 600 warheads. Yet what would be the point of a treaty signed by such notorious liars? I wouldn't trust Putin to keep his word. He violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Pact for years by secretly testing and deploying the SSC-8 cruise missile. And Trump rips up treaties just for the fun of it, even the ones he negotiated himself. In his first term, he pulled out of the Arms Trade Treaty and NAFTA, the latter apparently just so he could rename it USMCA, which starts with U.S., instead of the namby-pamby North America. This term, he has breached that pact by hitting Mexico and Canada with tariffs. With these two men as leaders of the biggest nuclear powers, we are doomed to a world without warhead limits. And that is a much more dangerous world. Written by Susan Caskey, the executive editor of The Week. On page four, the first article, Democrats push for ICE accountability. What happened? White House border czar Tom Homan this week announced that he was pulling 700 immigration agents from Minneapolis and refocusing the enforcement blitz there, as Democratic lawmakers demanded Congress place new restrictions on immigration and customs enforcement, and other agencies they say have descended into lawlessness. Homan, whom President Trump put in charge of the operation as outrage swelled over the killings of protesters Renee Good and Alex Pretty, cited unprecedented collaboration from local officials who are allowing ICE to take custody of undocumented inmates before they are released from jails. He said there would be a shift away from broad street sweeps to operations focused on immigrants with criminal records. But Homan stressed that Trump was still committed to mass deportations. If you are in the country illegally, he said, you are not off the table. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called the reduction a step in the right direction, but noted that with about 2,000 agents still on the ground, it was not de-escalation. Homan's announcement came a day after U.S. citizens who have been shot and violently detained by immigration agents testified at a Capitol Hill forum organized by Democrats. "I struggle every day with the pain and suffering," said Miramar Martinez, 30, a Chicagoan who was shot five times by a Border Patrol agent after she tailed the officer's vehicle in her car. Goods brother Luke Ganger told the forum that federal agents' aggressive actions are changing the community and changing many lives, including ours, forever. House Democrats released a report slamming agents' unlawful tactics as lawmakers voted to end a partial government shutdown and negotiated over new accountability measures that would be built into a funding package for the Department of Homeland Security. "DHS is completely out of control," said Robert Garcia. "Congress has a responsibility to step in." In Portland, Oregon, Mayor Keith Wilson demanded agents leave the city after they lobbed tear gas at demonstrators, including young children, engaging in a peaceful protest outside an ICE facility. In Minnesota, federal judge Patrick Schultz decried ICE's defiance of court orders, saying the agency has ignored at least 96 judicial directives this year. "That should give pause to anyone, no matter his or her political beliefs, who cares about the rule of law," wrote the George W. Bush appointee. What the columnists have had to say about this. "Tensions in the Twin Cities remain high," said Lewis Krause in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. "But residents, protesters, and city officials report a seeming change in agents' tactics. They include fewer ICE caravans, fewer agents on foot rousting pedestrians, and fewer confrontations with protesters. But intense fights still break out daily between agents and protesters following them." Videos posted on social media this week showed agents pointing guns at observers, trailing in an SUV, forcing them out of the vehicle and detaining them. In neighborhoods once alive with the pulse of immigrant communities, the crackdown has fractured families, rattled worried neighbors, and left residents feeling unsafe, said Ala Essar of CNN.com. Ryan Strangford never imagined he'd see his tree-lined, lake-dotted hometown transformed into a battleground, by which he likens it to a military occupation. U.S. citizens and immigrants alike are choosing to stay home, keep their kids out of school, he said. There's just overall a feeling of fear and dread. Far from de-escalating, ICE is seeking to expand its authority, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. The agency has authorized officers to arrest anyone they suspect of being undocumented, even if agents lack a warrant and the person isn't a flight risk. That license for agents to grab just about anyone they want came on the heels of another legally indefensible memo, which said officers could enter homes of suspected undocumented migrants without a judicial warrant. It all reveals an agency bent on making its agents into an all-powerful police force. Judge Schultz flags another alarming trend, said law professor Ryan Goodman in The New Yorker. The growing lawlessness of an administration engaged in flagrant defiance of court orders. The nearly 100 cases Schultz cited included repeated instances where the administration has refused orders to release detainees or present them in court, or has transferred them to other jurisdictions against direct orders. Their contempt of court is truly extraordinary and may be moving us towards a constitutional crisis. Such actions are unsettling Americans, and not just Democrats, said William A. Galston in the Wall Street Journal. More than a third of 2024 Trump voters said in a Politico poll that while they backed the president's mass deportations campaign, they disapprove of how it's being done. In a Harvard-Harris poll, majorities said federal agents have gone too far and are all violating civil liberties, while a Pew poll found that Americans by wide margins think it unacceptable for agents to stop and question people based upon their appearance or the language they speak. Time will tell if the administration's de-escalation talk is sincere or just a cheap public relations dodge, said Andrew Eagar in The Bulwark. But even if it's the former, these systems now have a logic of their own. Homeland Security has systematically built ICE into something that looks less like a disciplined law enforcement agency than a small paramilitary force recruiting bigoted meatheads with anti-immigrant propaganda and sending them into U.S. cities with minimal training. Once you've created the monster, it won't be easily tamed. So what's next? As Congress prepares to debate measures to set limits on ICE agents, a nasty standoff seems in store, said Sarah Ferris in CNN.com. Democrats are insisting on dramatic reforms, but House Speaker Mike Johnson is flatly ruling out two of their biggest demands, ending searches without judicial warrants and forbidding agents from wearing masks. Meanwhile, many Republicans are issuing their own demands, like an end to so-called sanctuary cities, a non-starter for Democrats. As the parties spar, there's a battle within the GOP over what reforms to make, said Alexander Bolton in The Hill. Some Republicans want to quell public backlash to the good and pretty shootings by supporting modest reforms such as de-escalation training for agents. But they're under the fire from harder-edged colleagues who want to go on offense by accusing Democrats of undermining law enforcement. Reaching a deal to fund DHS within the two-week deadline looks unlikely, said Senator John Kennedy, a Republican of Louisiana. I think DHS is going to be shut down for a while. We'll see. In the news, under the section and how they were covered, U.S. sends armada steaming toward defiant Iran. What happened? Iran matched the U.S. military escalation in its backyard with its own provocations this week, launching a drone at a U.S. carrier in the Arabian Sea and harassing a U.S. oil tanker with gunboats in the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. shot down this drone and escorted the tanker to safety. Despite the flare-ups, both sides said they were willing to negotiate over a possible deal to limit Iran's nuclear aspirations, though Iran insisted on moving the talks from Turkey to Oman and reducing their scope. The U.S. has sent the USS Abraham Lincoln carrier strike group with over 10 warships and multiple squadrons of fighter jets to the Arabian Sea. Bases, and Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan host additional U.S. forces. We have a large armada, flotilla, call it whatever you want, heading toward Iran right now, even larger than what we had in Venezuela, Trump said. If we can work something out, that would be great, and if we can't, probably bad things would happen. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei countered with his own bellicose rhetoric, saying that any U.S. attack would start a regional war, implying that Iranian proxies abroad would target U.S. forces on Middle East bases. Khamenei also described the mass nationwide protests his regime brutally suppressed last month as an attempted coup. Iranian state media said some 3,000 people were killed in the demonstrations, but U.S. experts estimate the true figure at around 7,000. And Iranian dissidents suggest a toll as high as 30,000. At the peak of the protests, Trump told Iranian demonstrators to stay in the streets, saying help is on its way. But he backtracked after Iran promised to stop the killing. What the columnist said. Getting an accurate death toll in Iran is vital, said Scott Anderson in the New York Times. For starters, it's a step in providing a sense of justice for the victims. It's also a morbid way to measure just how concerned Khamenei is about losing its grip on the Iranian people. Across Iran, civilians have reported mass graves, morgues overflowing with body bags, and relatives and neighbors disappearing without a trace. More than 40,000 people were arrested, including children. Clearly, the regime has been shaken by the aspiring and fears for its survival. That is why it's unconscionable that Trump lost interest in the protests for a free Iran, said Dim Garrity in the National Review. We have an erratic president who veers back and forth between promises of help and threats of force, and then talks up how much he wants to work out a deal. But what is there to talk about? He already claimed to have obliterated Iran's nuclear programs with last year's bombing run. Perhaps it's all a ruse, meant to lull the mullahs into a false sense of security ahead of some massive regime change strike. But it just looks like weakness. Regime change is what Iran needs, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The time to barter with this brutal theocratic government is long past. Trump could not offer sanctions relief in exchange for paper promises about nuclear enrichment concessions or even in exchange for limits on Iran's missiles or terrorist support. Not that those seem to be on the table. Instead, he must help the protesters topple the Ayatollah and his enforcers. The armada is in place. Use it. Don't assume that what comes after the regime's fall will be better, said Harlan Ullman in The Hill. The clerical oligarchy that's in charge now has been a political, social, moral, and economic disaster for Iran, but the Revolutionary Guard with its fanatical QUDSs and Bazij wings could be even more tyrannical. Worse, these groups might not be bound by the Islamic dictate that holds that nuclear weapons are sinful and forbidden. If this awful regime could be replaced peacefully and civilly, that would be miraculous, but I'm not betting on it. Using force against Iran could actually backfire, said Imran Khalid in Newsweek. By building up its military presence, Washington is providing Khamenei with the boogeyman he needs, and the U.S. may unwittingly be on its way toward hijacking an organic domestic movement for change and turning it into a nationalist war of defense. Restraint, on the other hand, might allow the internal contradictions of the Iranian regime to collapse it organizationally. Right now, both sides are holding a match over a powder keg, convinced the other will be the first to blink. In such a scenario, everyone ends up getting burned. Meanwhile, it wasn't all bad. A St. Louis neighborhood is thanking a plowing vigilante for voluntarily cleaning its streets with a Bobcat construction vehicle he rented out of his own pocket. Kenneth Harrell doesn't live in the neighborhood, but he sprang to the rescue after seeing cars still stuck in the storm days after a recent storm had passed. Harrell took out the machine on his own with no intention of being paid back. It just didn't make sense to me, Harrell said, that people could get out of the house but not off the street. A simple act of kindness on a cold Chicago street made school crossing guard Joe Sass a viral sensation recently. Seventh grader José Enrique Rodriguez was nearly at school when he arrived at a crosswalk that was submerged in deep icy water. Sass approached and asked, "Would it be okay if I picked you up on my shoulder?" The 44-year-old carried the teen past two crosswalks and dropped him off on dry land. Unbeknownst to them, WGN Morning News Skycam captured the lift and it went viral. Sass's friend created a GoFundMe for him, which has collected over $10,000. Sass said he will give half the money to a local nonprofit and the other half to immigrant-owned businesses. Number three, Austin Appleby pulled off an Olympic feat last week when the 13-year-old swam 4 hours to seek help after his family became stranded in shark-infested waters off the coast of Western Australia. Appleby, two younger siblings, and mother Joanne were on a kayak and inflatable paddle boards when strong winds swept them out into the Indian Ocean. To save his family, Appleby swam for 2.5 miles to reach the shore. I just kept thinking, keep on swimming, Appleby said. Emergency crews rescued his mom and siblings and called the boy's efforts superhuman. Oh, that's the wrong one, for Christ's sakes. Oh, wait a minute. Here. The controversy of the week. Fulton County, Georgia, a dress rehearsal for election theft. When FBI agents raided an election center in Fulton County last week, carting off 700 boxes of ballots and related documents, some commentators shrugged that it was just another doomed attempt by President Trump to substantiate his big lie of the stolen 2020 election. But the real goal is likely far more nefarious, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg. Facing a GOP wipeout in November's midterms, which would end his ability to fend off accountability, Trump is mobilizing the government to find or create evidence of electoral malfeasance in Democratic precincts as a pretext for Republicans taking control of ballots in key states in November. Trump himself confirmed the plan this week, declaring that he wants to nationalize the elections and have the federal government, meaning Republicans, tally ballots in states he deems guilty of electoral corruption. His lackeys to do the dirty work, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's de facto voter fraud czar, was on site for the Fulton raid. By statute, the nation's top sty boss is barred from involvement in domestic law enforcement. But as White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt explained it, Gabbard is committed to ensuring a U.S. election can never, ever be rigged again. Trump will certainly try to tamper with the midterms, said Nick Scotoggio in the Dispatch. But to understand last week's raid, we shouldn't discount the president's aggrieved paranoia about Georgia, and Fulton County in particular. Bogus tales of shenanigans by black poll workers at Atlanta's State Farm Arena are among Trump's favorite lies to explain his 2020 loss in the Peach State. And it was Fulton's district attorney, Fannie Willis, who later indicted Trump for trying to overturn the election, including by pressuring Georgia's Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes, forcing him through the humiliation of fingerprinting and a mugshot. This raid may have been part revenge for those ignominies, partially preemptive therapy for the right's next painful defeat. This is about more simply keeping Trump happy, said Philip Bump in MS Now. Days before the raid, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote to Minnesota Governor Jim Waltz, suggesting the Trump administration would withdraw ICE agents from his state if he handed over all the state's voter records. Minnesota, one of two dozen mostly Democratic-led states the administration has used to get their voter rolls, refused the request. Is the big plan to identify and purge Democratic voters, or merely to gin up more bogus claims of fraud? We don't know. But the threat to American democracy could not be more villainous if it were spelled out in letters clipped from the newspapers and magazines. The president's gambit is working, said Jeet Hare in The Nation. Even if Gabbard and FBI boss Kash Patel find no crimes in Fulton, and even if Democrats recapture the House in November, Trump will point to stunts like the Georgia raid to justify ignoring congressional oversight. We're facing horrors far worse than that, said David French in the New York Times. The administration is already defying court orders and is already deploying masked agents to terrorize Latino and minority communities. In November, how many minority voters will risk a trip to their polling station? And how many, when they get there, will find they're no longer on the voting rolls? Yes, it's only February, but Trump is stealing the midterms, or trying to, right now, right in front of our eyes. Ancillary articles on the same page, only in America. Mississippi court has reinstated an assistant principal fired for reading "Need a New Butt" to second graders. Toby Price was dismissed in 2022 after officials determined that the picture book about a boy who thinks his behind is broken because it has a crack in it was inappropriate. The court called the decision arbitrary and capricious, given that other books at the school library mentioned butts or included images of nudity. Second paragraph, Oklahoma lawmakers are considering legislation that would require strippers to be licensed by the state. Two bills introduced by Republicans would bar those convicted of certain felonies from entering the profession and require aspiring strippers to produce government-issued photo ID, an anti-trafficking measure, said State Rep. Stan May. Whether you agree with these places or not, we should all agree people participating should be doing it of their own free will. It was a good week for candor after government lawyer Julie Lee, asked by a Minnesota judge to explain why ICE and Homeland Security have defied so many court orders lately, expressed her own frustration with the noncompliance and her crushing workload. "The system sucks, this job sucks," Lee told the judge. She was removed from her post soon after. It's a good week for Renaissance men, after researchers announced that they may have recovered fragments of DNA belonging to artist and polymath Leonardo da Vinci, extracted from the Holy Child, a circa 1510 chalk drawing. The DNA could, if authenticated, settle the authorship of disputed masterpieces. It was a good week for vote rigging, after New York Magazine reported that Rep. Nancy Mace, a Republican of South Carolina, once ordered a staffer to go on Reddit forums about the hottest women in Congress and boost her standings in the rankings. A Mace spokesperson called the allegations ridiculous. It was a bad week for playing soldiers, after a man presented to an emergency room in Toulouse, France, with a World War I artillery round lodged in his rectum. After removing the item, surgeons alerted the local bomb squad. He determined that the shell did not present a risk of explosion. It was a bad week for polar bears. After Polar Plunge Myrtle Beach, a cold water swimming event to raise funds for the Special Olympics, was canceled due to dangerously cold temperatures, organizers told the South Carolinians who would have participated to stay home, stay warm, and stay safe. It was a bad week for cybersecurity. After Hamadou Goutoumoukala, interim head of the U.S. Cyber Defense Agency, uploaded sensitive contracting documents to a public version of ChatGPT, making the information available to the AI chatbox more than 700 million users. A spokesperson said the agency remained committed to harnessing AI. In other news, Gabbard accused of playing politics with intelligence report. Copies of a highly classified complaint against Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard were hand-delivered to lawmakers this week after months of wrangling in which Gabbard was accused of deliberately stonewalling the whistleblower. Filed last May, the complaint centers on an accusation that Gabbard restricted the distribution of an intelligence report for political purposes, reports CNN.com. The material in the complaint was so sensitive that it was locked in a safe, and one official said disclosure of its contents could cause grave damage to national security. A watchdog deemed the allegation not credible, but federal law allows whistleblowers to refer their complaints to the Gang of Eight lawmakers, even if they are found not credible, which the whistleblower's lawyer said his client was blocked from doing. Gabbard's office called the allegation baseless and politically motivated. The U.S. at a glance. Springfield, Ohio. Haitians can stay. A federal judge this week temporarily blocked the Trump administration from stripping more than 350,000 Haitians of protection from deportation to Haiti, a country gripped by gang violence. In a blistering ruling, Judge Anna Reis in Washington said Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem had no authority to end temporary protected status for Haitians, first granted after an earthquake in 2010 and sent to expire this week. Reis accused Noem of hostility to non-white immigrants and said Haitians are hardworking people who are here legally and contribute billions to the economy. DHS called Reis, a Biden appointee, an activist judge, and vowed to appeal. Rose Thamar Joseph of the Haitian Support Center in Springfield, a city spotlighted in President Trump's baseless 2024 claim that Haitians were eating people's pets, said the decision was a relief but noted that the legal fight was not over. But we can breathe for a little bit. In Tucson, Arizona, taken. Authorities intensified their search this week for the mother of today's show host, Savannah Guthrie, who they believe may have been kidnapped and possibly held for ransom. Nancy Guthrie, 84, disappeared from her home in the Catalina foothills near Tucson, and the gossip site TMZ and CBS's Tucson affiliate both received alleged ransom notes. TMZ said its note demanded a Bitcoin payment. Nancy was last seen entering her home on January 31st. When she wasn't in church the next day, she was reported missing, and police found blood splattered on the doorstep and the house in disarray. A security camera was gone, but her phone, wallet, car, and life-saving medications were still there. DNA from the scene has not so far yielded a lead. Nancy has physical ailments limiting her mobility, and Savannah Guthrie pulled out of covering the Winter Olympics for NBC. We do not believe that Nancy was taken from her home against her will, said Pima Sheriff Chris Nanos. That's where we're at. From White Plains, New York. Detransitioning. A New York jury this week awarded $2 million in damage to a woman who underwent gender transition surgery as a teenager that she says left her disfigured for life. The first malpractice verdict over so-called gender-affirming care for minors. Fox Varian, 22, was assigned female at birth but began identifying it as male at 15. After struggling with depression and other mental health issues. At 16, Varian had a double mastectomy, but later regretted the decision and reverted to identifying as a woman. Varian filed for medical practice lawsuit in 2023 against her psychologist and plastic surgeon. saying they coerced her into the procedure without obtaining adequate consent regarding the risks. Meanwhile, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons this week became the first major medical group to oppose gender-related chest, genital, and facial surgery for young people. It recommended that such surgeries be delayed until a patient is at least 19. From Fort Worth, Texas, a Democratic victory. A Texas Democrat flipped a state Senate seat last week in a ruby-red district that President Trump won by 17 percentage points in 2024, the latest in a series of upsets signaling possible trouble for Republicans in this year's midterms. Union leader and Air Force veteran Taylor Rimmett trounced Trump-endorsed Republican Lee Wamgus 57% to 43% in the runoff to fill a vacant seat in suburban Fort Worth. Rimmett, 33, largely ran on his working-class background, avoiding hot-button cultural issues. Analysts noted that he won over many socially conservative Latino voters who flocked to Trump in 2024. Republicans rallied behind Wamgus, whose campaign raised over $2.6 million, but turnout was low despite calls from Trump urging Republicans to vote. After the election, Trump deflected any suggestion that the setback reflected negatively on him, saying, "I'm not involved in that." From New York City, a spared death. A Manhattan federal judge last week dropped death penalty charges against Luigi Mangione, the 27-year-old accused of killing United Healthcare CEO on a New York street in 2024. Judge Margaret Gannett dismissed two firearms charges, including one count of using a firearm to commit murder, which carries a potential death sentence. Garnett based her decision on an interpretation of the law that requires that the killing be committed during another crime of violence. Mangione still faces two federal stalking charges, which carry maximum sentences of life in prison without parole, and a state murder charge. Mangione's case has generated a cult-like following among people who believe the CEO's murder was justified by the unfairness of the healthcare system. A Minnesota man, Mark Anderson, impersonated an FBI agent in a failed attempt to spring Mangione from jail last week. Authorities arrested Anderson, 36, who told jail officers he was in possession of paperwork signed by a judge to free the alleged killer. And finally, from Washington, D.C., the Clinton's cave. Former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton this week reached a deal with House Republicans to testify in the chamber's investigation of Jeffrey Epstein, avoiding a vote to hold them a criminal contempt of Congress. The Clintons previously defied subpoenas for questioning about their connections to the sex offender. Republicans and Democrats on the House Oversight Committee voted last night to hold them in contempt, teeing up a full House vote. The couple had called the subpoenas a political attack, but in a sharp reversal, they agreed to appear for depositions, preempting the final vote. Bill Clinton flew repeatedly on Epstein's private jet, but both Clintons maintained they didn't know about Epstein's alleged sex trafficking. Committee Chair James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, plans to videotape the late February depositions, and the couple requested the proceedings be made public in the interest of transparency and fairness. "No one is above the law," said Comer, "and that includes the Clintons." Moving on to the world at a glance from the week February 13th, 2026. Paris, X crackdown. French police raided the Paris offices of X this week and summoned a billionaire owner, Elon Musk, for voluntary questioning in a widening investigation into the social media company. France started examining X last year after suspecting it from that it was tweaking its algorithms to promote racist and other harmful content. Now authorities are also examining sexualized deepfakes and Holocaust denial content generated by X's A1 chat box, Grok, G-R-O-K. The European Union has also launched a separate investigation of Grok's production of images showing women and children digitally undressed, according to users' requests. Musk called the raid on his offices a political attack, and X's government affairs department labeled it an abusive act of law enforcement theater designed to achieve illegitimate political objectives. From Rome, the angel Meloni. The Catholic Church and the Italian government both launched investigations this week after a restored painting in the Basilica of St. Lawrence was unveiled to show an angel bearing a striking resemblance to Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. The Basilica, one of Rome's oldest churches, was mobbed over the weekend as gawkers strained to take photos disrupting religious services. The previously generic-looking angel, repainted after sustaining water damage, is shown kneeling in deference to Italy's last king, Umberto II, a supporter of fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. Meloni's party has its root in a party founded by Mussolini supporters. The angel was quickly painted over. From Mexico City, new turf. Mexican drug cartels have expanded into a new business, vaping, after the government last month imposed a ban on the sale, but not the use, of e-cigarettes. Vaping, a $1.3 billion per year industry in Mexico, offers a lower-risk revenue stream for cartels as the Trump administration threatens to target them with military strikes. Over the several years, the government spent passing the constitutional amendment and laws to ban tapes, cartels began seizing stores and intimidating competitors. The full prohibition took effect January 16, and Mexico City authorities confiscated more than 500,000 vapes the next day. Lawyer Juan Jose Sirion Lee said the ban will end up exposing teens to new risks because the dangerous criminals selling cocaine, fentanyl, and marijuana can now start a relationship with them by selling vapes. From Havana, Cuba. Anger at the U.S. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel accused the U.S. last week of trying to suffocate his country after President Trump signed an executive order threatening to raise tariffs on any country exporting oil to the communist-run island. Truma called Cuba an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, but later said that his administration was starting to talk to its leaders. Trump said Mexico would stop sending oil to Cuba, but Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum denied that and said her government was exploring all diplomatic avenues to continue sending Cuba fuel. Mexico surpassed Venezuela as Cuba's largest oil supplier last year when the U.S. was blockading Venezuela, but Cuba still lacks sufficient supplies and suffers rolling blackouts. From London, the Epstein fallout. Prime Minister Keir Starmer called this week for Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, the former prince, to testify to the U.S. Congress about his Epstein ties after newly released photos showed him kneeling over an unidentified woman. And Peter Mandelson, a former British ambassador to the U.S., resigned from the House of Lords and the Labour Party after revelations that he had funneled secret economic information to Epstein and received payments from Epstein totaling $75,000. Mendelsohn said he didn't remember the payments but didn't want to cause further embarrassment. In Slovakia, meanwhile, National Security Advisor Miroslav Lijak resigned after it emerged that he'd maintained contact with Epstein after the financier was imprisoned for soliciting a minor. From Panama City, China out. In a victory for President Trump's campaign to curb Chinese influence in the Americas, Panama's Supreme Court last week annulled a contract that has let a Hong Kong company operate ports on opposite sides of the Panama Canal since 1999. The court said the arrangement with a subsidiary of Hong Kong-based CK Hutchison Holdings was unconstitutional because it was against Panama's interests to give a foreign company tax breaks and exclusive rights to run the two ports. Last year, Hutchison agreed to sell the ports to a group led by U.S. investment firm BlackRock, but China opposed the sale. Trump has been pressuring Panama over the canal's operation since he took office. In his inaugural address, he suggested the U.S. should take back the strategic waterways it ceded in 1999, saying, "We didn't give it to China." From Kyiv in the Ukraine, Russia kills the beast. Russia hammered Ukrainian energy facilities with missiles and drones this week, a day after President Trump and President Vladimir Putin had agreed to spare power plants for a week as civil employees endure bitter cold. Authorities said it was Russia's worst attack on the Ukraine's grid this winter and included 70 missiles and 45 attack drones, several times more powerful than Russia's typical overnight bombing waves. Millions of Ukrainians were left without power at temperatures plunged to minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Kiev said Russia was weaponizing winter ahead of the next round of peace negotiations, taking advantage of the coldest days of winter to terrorize people, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said, is more important to Russia than turning to diplomacy. From Mozambique, floods kill. The death toll from flooding in southern Africa rose to more than 100 last week, with another month still to come in the rainy season. Dozens have died across Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Mozambique. At least three people in Mozambique, the worst-hit country, were killed by crocodiles that swam into villages from overflowing rivers. Some 400,000 people in the region have been forced to flee their mud brick or adobe homes as the waters rose over the past few weeks. Gaspar Sitfane, director of Water Aid Mozambique, warned that the refugee camps trying to accommodate these displaced people lack good toilets, clean water, and sufficient garbage disposal facilities. For sure, soon, we will have cases of cholera, he said. Relief officials are asking donors for $187 million to meet urgent needs. From Tokyo, no trash cans. Japan welcomed a record 42.7 million tourists last year. Data released last week showed, but many of them had a complaint. In the famously tidy country, there are almost no public trash cans. The bins were removed after 1995 when the Shikido Doomsday Cult released sarin in the Tokyo subway, killing 13 people. Authorities feared gas devices could be hidden in bins, so Japanese people got used to hauling their trash around until they got home. Cities have tried to make tourists aware of the practice through publicity campaigns, but littering is on the rise. Miranda Castleberry, 32, told the Wall Street Journal she ended up buying a jacket with huge pockets to house her takeout cups and other garbage during a three-week trip through Japan. I've never been a human trash can before, she said. From Gaza, the border opens. Israel reopened the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza this week after nearly 2 years, a step forward in the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Rafah offers a lifeline for sick and injured Palestinians trapped in the bombed-out enclave. Hundreds of people immediately lined up on both sides of the border, but only a few dozen got through in the first several days. The Gaza Health Ministry estimates that 20,000 people need to leave for medical care abroad. Many others displaced by the war, which killed tens of thousands and destroyed 80% of Gaza's buildings. They hope to return. Gaza is home, said Mohammed Talil, 28, one of the 100,000 who fled through Rafah early in the war. Going back to live in a tent? I don't care. From India, fatal virus spreads. Kolkata, India. Airports across Asia went on alert last week as authorities scrambled to contain an outbreak of deadly Nipah virus in Kolkata. Nipah causes fever, headache, cough, and muscle pain that can progress to fatal brain swelling. There is no treatment, and up to 70% of those infected die within 2 days of symptom onset. The outbreak began last month in India's West Bengal state, where Indian health authorities confirmed two infections among nurses at a Kolkata hospital. Now Thailand and Pakistan have begun COVID-style screening of passengers from West Bengal, South Asian countries, especially Bangladesh and India, see small outbreaks of Nipah nearly every year, but public awareness of the disease is not widespread. The virus tends to be transmitted to humans from animals such as fruit bats, and humans can pass it on to other people. Under the section titled Briefing, The Price of Sporting Glory, the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics kicked off this week. Will Italy regret playing host? Was Italy ready for the games? Not entirely, but the Winter Olympics are now underway, and over the next 2 weeks, more than 3,500 athletes from 93 countries will compete across 16 sports, ranging from alpine skiing to luge to figure skating. These Olympics are the most geographically spread out of any games in history, with 25 sporting venues and 6 Olympic villages spanning some 8,495 square miles in northern Italy. The two main hubs, the cities of Milan and the alpine resort of Cortina d'Ampezzo, sit 250 miles apart. Construction delays and cost overruns have plagued the games. Days before the opening ceremony, work was still ongoing on the Santa Giulia Arena, a new $292 million ice hockey venue in Milan. It was originally budgeted at $210 million. Some locals have been angered by the event's environmental cost. Cortina Mayor Gianluca Lorenzi received death threats after century-old trees were felled to make way for a $131 million bobsledding track. Lorenzi insists the project is an added value for Cortina. But history shows that the Olympics often leave behind a legacy of debt, white elephants, and bitterness. How much do these games cost? The Milan Cortina Olympics have an operating budget of about $1.9 billion, which is largely covered by broadcasting and sponsorship deals and sales of tickets and merchandise. But that budget does not include capital costs, including the construction of new Olympic venues or improvements to rail or road systems. The Italian government allocated about $4.2 billion in public money for infrastructure spending. The International Olympic Committee argues that the Games pay for themselves by raising a city's profile and attracting tourists. And some reports suggest Milan Cortina could deliver a $6 billion economic boost. But most host cities do not see a positive return on investment. Beijing spent $40 billion on the 2008 Summer Games and generated only $3.6 billion in revenue, while London, 2012, spent $18 billion and generated $5.2 billion. For many cities in many countries, says sports economist Robert Batty, the Olympics are a money-hemorrhaging endeavor. Why are the Games so expensive? It's partly because they've expanded to allow more events, more athletes, more venues, and more spectators. But it's also due to each host city's wanting their games to be more impressive than the predecessors. One-upsmanship, extravagant architectural plans, and a comparatively short construction schedule result in big bills, which are often not reflected in the original bids. An Oxford University study found that from 1960 to 2016, host cities went over budget by an average of 156%. For some games, the cost override was far higher. The 2014 Winter Games in Sochi cost Russia at least $30 billion, 289% more than was expected at the time of bidding, and the 1976 Games in Montreal went 720% over projections, leaving the city with a $1.5 billion debt. Team USA's big hopes. Team USA has some major names looking to grab new glories in Milan Cortina. Alpine skiing could add extensive medal collections, and her teammate Lindsey Vonn's quest for gold was thrown into doubt after she crashed during airlift and had to be airlifted to the hospital. Vonn, 41, who came out of retirement in 2024, posted online that she'd be injured her left knee, but insisted, "My Olympic dream is not over." And snowboarder Chloe Kim is seeking her third Olympic gold medal, while world champion figure skater Elisa Liu and Amber Glenn, the first openly LGBTQ plus woman to become a figure skating national champion, our podium contenders. And we have now reached our limit for today. So this is Ken from the Talking Information Center on Thursday, Thursday, February the 12th, 2026, has been reading from the February 13th issue of The Week. Until the next time, wishing you a pleasant afternoon.